Hello everyone and welcome to Celebrating Cinema. I'm your host Elliot and today I'm joined by Tom.
Hello there.
Tom, how are you doing?
I am doing very well.
Today we thought it could be good to discuss the man, the myth, the legend, Orson Welles, as both Lab 111 and Odyssey Classics are doing a release of The Third Man and F for Fate. But before we get into that, Tom, I wanted to ask a bit about what you've been up to lately. You've been a bit of a busy man.
Yes. So for those who don't know, is next to being head of cinema of Lab 111, at some point we realized that I was dealing with classics so much of the time, that being a very difficult business sometimes to find the rights to screen films. We realized that it would be fun to start a distribution company so that we could distribute classics also in the entirety of the Benelux, so that more people could be part of this great way of screening classics and making it easier for other cinemas as well to screen them. So,
sorry, just to interrupt you. Benelux is Belgium, Netherlands, and Luxembourg, obviously.
Yeah, that's a strangely abbreviated collection of countries that for some reason are together.
Which sounds like its own cinema chain.
Yeah, Benelux cinemas. Yeah. We don't always do those countries as well, but we mostly focus on the Netherlands. And a while back, with my companions of Odyssey Classics, acquired the rights of Carol Reed's The Third Man, which is celebrating its 75th anniversary this year with a 4K restoration. That's from a while back, but it's now getting not only a Netherlands re-release, but also, I've just been told, a global re-release with screenings in Vienna, where the movie takes place. There's going to be an open-air cinema screening it with a view of the big Ferris wheel. That's like one of the most famous locations. Yeah, but we'll get to the minutiae of the film later. Yeah, that's what I've been busy with. And through a strange coincidence, I also, by happenstance almost, acquired the rights of F for Fake, the documentary that, or I should say, between air... what do you say, call these brackets?
Quotation marks.
Quotations, documentary by Orson Welles, which we're going to re-release in a new 4K restoration on the same date as The Third Man. So the conversation that we are here to, you invited me to have via this wonderfully shoddy internet connection, is going to be about Orson Welles and these films that are in a way inextricably linked only because of him, because The Third Man, of course, wasn't directed by Welles. It just features him. Well, it just, also air quotations, just features him in one of the most, iconic, maybe not roles, but 100% one of the most iconic
characters, at least.
The appearance of a character, right?
Yeah. Before we dive into The Third Man and F of Fake, I think it's good to say that obviously we don't think one episode could ever sort of do justice to the life of Orson Welles, because he has had a very colourful life, which I think could be discussed in so many different ways. And I think we'll no doubt return to some of his other films like Citizen Kane, for instance. But I think it could be good to give a good bit of context or background of who he is as a person and sort of how he stumbled, I would say, into the film world. Are you familiar a bit with his childhood? I was reading about it, and he sort of had to grow up very fast in many ways. His mother died at the age of 9, I believe.
Oh, wow.
And he came from quite a affluent background, and he ended up living with his father, who was sort of this raging alcoholic, and took him out of school and sort of traveled around America, but also Jamaica and the Far East. So his father ended up dying as well when he was 13 because of alcohol. And what happened after that, he was always in and out of school, and he basically took his inheritance, some of his inheritance money, to travel around Europe. And he ended up going around Ireland on a donkey by cart in a very awesome Welles way.
Yeah, which is also a weird way, because the thing that, and I don't want to fast forward through his career, but the thing that he always wanted to make was the Don Quixote movie,
yeah.
Which is also, of course, a man on a donkey, really. So,
yeah, And I should say that when he was at school, he did, he went to a very wealthy private school, but that was sort of his first interactions with theatre and radio. And I think there was where he really started to gain sort of this fascination or an obsession for it. But when he was in Ireland, basically what he did, he stumbled into a theatre in Dublin and announced himself in this very sort of charismatic way of being a Broadway star. And the owners of the theatre didn't necessarily believe him, but they were quite taken by his confidence for a 16-year-old.
So he already had that sort of, how shall we say that, in a way that it doesn't sound, because I love that about him. There's this, there is a sense in, especially if you look him up, right? If you look at how he looks, especially later on in life, especially in the 70s, where he's become this big man with this beard and a cane and a hat and like this long coat. He knew very well how the cultus of the him, right? Like how he was going to build that up. He almost became like, he built that icon for himself. He always almost, in that sense, reminds me a lot of Hitchcock, that at some point Hitchcock became that drawing of his face was just enough to actually think about the of what Hitchcock was. The belly, just if there's this drawing of the bald head of Hitchcock and then the belly coming out. I think he drew it himself. And then it's like, oh yeah, that's Hitchcock. And there's also this thing with Wells where, so it's funny to see that even when he's 16, he's already establishing himself as the story is maybe more important than the reality, which will, again, is a thing through his entire career, this play of things don't necessarily have to be true to be a story to be told.
When you mention Hitchcock's belly, there's this great American chat show that I stumbled across of Orson Welles and this other American celebrity who kind of sizes Orson Welles up.
Have you met Mr. Welles before?
Mr. Welles, you make Wimpy look skimpy.
Well, you see, I'm fat and you're ugly, but I can diet.
He basically ended up back in New York and was working on Broadway already as a teenager, and sort of his rise was pretty rapid. And I think he was also very good in Shakespeare plays. Something he's often accredited for is when he goes on to direct more theatre, which he did already in his early 20s. He was sort of one of the first people to set Shakespearean plays in modern day settings. So, for instance, I think it was Julius Caesar in a sort of this German fascist setting he would do. But alongside that, we'll slowly get to his filmmaking career, but he was also doing radio as well, sort of radio productions. And supposedly when he was at his peak of working between radio and theatre, he hired an ambulance to basically take him around New York City so he would make all his different set times or studio calls with the sirens on. You would think this is illegal, but apparently it was legal because no one thought anybody would be narcissistic enough to do something like this, which again captures Orson Welles pretty much.
Right, right. Yeah, and I mean, that of course leads to the whole radio thing, leads into the reason that RKO signed him to start off his career in cinema, is that he, at that time, he puts together a theater group called the Mercury Theater, which is going to be very influential in that time, together with a guy called John Houseman. And then at that time, he starts doing radio plays. And the radio play, the radio performance of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, that he records as though it is a news broadcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars. The spectroscope indicates the gas to be hydrogen and moving toward the Earth with enormous velocity. Professor Pearson of the observatory at Princeton confirms Farrell's observation and describes the phenomenon as, quote, like a jet of blue flame shot from a gun, unquote.
Well, the thing is, people actually think that aliens are landing. He did it so well that people thought, oh my God, the alien invasion is upon us. So all hell breaks loose. It's sensation. So on the cusp of that insane radio broadcast, RKO hires him to make a debut feature the most insane debut feature ever made, I would reckon. Which, of course, is Citizen Kane.
This is Orson Welles. I'm speaking for the Mercury Theater, and what follows is supposed to advertise our first motion picture. Citizen Kane is the title, and we hope it can correctly be called a coming attraction. It's certainly coming, coming to this theater, and I think our Mercury actors make it an attraction. Citizen Kane is a modern American story about a man called Kane, Charles Foster Kane. I don't know what you'll think about Mr. Kane. I can't imagine. You see, I play the part myself. Well, Kane is a hero and a scoundrel, a no-account and a swell guy, a great lover, a great American citizen, and a dirty dog. It depends on who's talking about him. What's the real truth about Charles Foster Kane? I wish you'd come to this theater when Citizen Kane plays here and decide for yourself.
The War of the Worlds radio series turned into sort of this, like, overnight celebrity, which I think is why the studio RKO took such a chance on him. I think they were in a financial trouble at the time, and it was sort of this big risk. Citizen Kane, I think, he makes it at 26, right?
Yeah, yeah. 26 years old. We can say a lot about the film, but first and foremost, it's an insane movie to be made by a 26-year-old man.
Yeah, it's crazy. I'm 26 now, and I don't think I have a Citizen Kane in me yet, sadly.
We'll see about that.
Maybe at 27, we'll see.
Yeah, you don't know.
Obviously, we're not going to go into depth here about Citizen Kane, but perhaps you can nicely summarize why it is so influential, or it is considered one of the greatest, if not the greatest film of all time. And I think it is one of those films that does hold up even now every time you view it, which is pretty special.
Well, Elliot, does it now?
Oh,
yeah. No, well, I'm not going to say that Orson Welles is a hack. I'm not going to say that. So I showed you before we started recording, I showed you this book. It's a book that they use in film studies a lot. It's called History of Narrative Film. I think there are two books. This is one of the books that you had to have during film studies. This printing is the printing from 1981. So it's incredibly old and incredibly dated. And there is no, it's way more about old white dead men than the new versions of this book are. There's no influential Thai cinema in here, for instance. But what I find interesting is that when I was a little bit younger, when I bought this book secondhand, I used to see Kane on all the, especially the American Film Institute, always listed Citizen Kane as the number one, the best film ever made. So as a young movie buff, you wanted to see that film and see, wow, what is really up?
Yeah.
Now, lately, I've been having discussions with younger friends who, or people who speak with me when I'm in lab or when I'm at the cinema, and younger colleagues. And they're sometimes I feel that for some people, it's very hard to watch a very old film and then do something with that stamp of it being a masterpiece or it being super influential. And they just see the film for what it is and go like, well, that was kind of fucking boring. It's hard if something is considered so greatly to actually see it with your own eyes and then judge it, right? In that same way. Sometimes it's hard to see what it is. And I think with Kane through the years, if I read this book, there's Orson Welles has his own chapter in this book, and it's called Orson Welles and the Modern Sound Film. And yes, it goes pre-Kane to Kane, post-Kane. I do think that Welles is very influential, and I do think that especially Citizen Kane is an incredibly influential film when it comes to deep focus photography, editing, how you tell a long form biographical story, because it's about America's most powerful press newspaper
tycoon
William Randolph Hearst, who was at the time still alive. So that led to an incredible controversy, of course, when the movie came out, because how are you going to tell a story about somebody who's still alive when it's a pretty damning story as well? But it's this sweeping tale about his life and also, well, his death. Not spoiler, because the movie starts with that. That's where the whole Rosebud thing comes from, the word that everybody associates with this film.
Rosebud.
What does Rosebud mean? Oh, my God. It's like the what's in the box Seven moment.
Seems that envy is my sin.
No, what's in the box?
Not till you give me the
what's
gun.
What's in the fucking box?
Give me the gun.
Of Citizen Kane. I won't spoil it for anybody. I mean, are there spoilers for Citizen Kane? I mean, is that, you know, I don't know. Anyway, the movie starts off with him saying that in the entire film is, I mean, this sweeping tale of his rise to power and his world is his grip on the newspaper world and press and in the end, the Rosebud word is a name for something that he holds dearly and shows something about the feelings of this tycoon, as you rightfully say so. But to go back to the influence and the whole, is it the best film ever made? While thinking about this, I started to realize that it's a hard thing to say. I think for American cinema, yes. I think Kane can always be up there. I think it's sometimes flipping places with, well, one of my favorite films of all time and by a man who I already mentioned, Vertigo by Hitchcock, which is also very much quintessentially a very American film. Kane is not anymore like in the Sight and Sound polls on number one. Last time that was Chantal Akerman of Jeanne Dieleman by Chantal Akerman. So I think you can clearly see how things like this change. There's never forever going to be the best movie ever. It's never going to be Citizen Kane. But what I maybe just wanted to say in a very convoluted way is that I think it's difficult to things like that sometimes don't really help a movie. It maybe clouds your judgment when seeing something like this. So if people listen to this podcast and they hear Kane and they're like, oh God, it's that film that I need to find amazing.
Yeah.
I would advise people to watch it just a little bit in mind that things that you can see in that film, for instance, I always despise a bit the French term mise-en-scène, but sometimes they call it blocking, how people are like lined in the frame. If you look at one of the most famous scenes, which is a very, very minor dialogue scene between a man and three other guys, the way that Wells puts people in the frame is so beautifully constructed in such a way that's almost like a painting where everybody has its place. And due to the deep focus photography, you can see the depth of the entire background of the office, of the newspaper and stuff like that. These are very minor things that are hard to appreciate now because cinema has evolved to such an extent that we've seen these things many times in many different ways. And now that shot, for instance, was created by putting one of the actors that you actually look over his shoulder is way up higher than Wells is sitting. He's in this sort of pit. That was the only way to make it so that the camera would line up in such a way that you could both see the background and the actors in the front, but also Wells, who's way more down. Or it's a weird shot. And it's these very sort of, inventive things that he comes up with. Let's be very frank. It is a big budget studio film that completely destroyed RKO and in a sense also destroyed Wells' career. But when it came out, it was considered, and it says in this book very nicely, it was considered an experimental film. It was in no way the sort of the big budget, big biographical epic that we now see it as.
It's very anti-establishment.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, no, it's very radical in a way, even though if anybody would ask me what is Kane about, and I say it's a biopic about a guy who has a newspaper, and it's pretty long, you have this sort of 90s Forrest Gump idea of a movie, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even like the first frames where you see like newsreel footage of him, there's this often told story that the way that Wells made that look like found footage almost. He shot it, then he took out the frames, and then he had a car ride over it a couple of times. And then they sort of reloaded the celluloid in camera. So that's how you get to... These are things that sound so trivial now, maybe, but were like completely radical at that time.
Yeah, I think it's funny that you mentioned how this title of it being a masterpiece or greatest film of all time, set in quotation marks, can perhaps influence or how you then go on to watch it. Because I think that mark of the film, because already when it came out, people were already within the first few years of the film's release, considering it as one of the greatest films of all time at that time. And I think that followed Orson Welles throughout his career in the sense what strikes me most, the two things about this film, is A, how similar his life has played out to William Randolph Hearst or Citizen Kane in the film, which I think is quite interesting. And you see it in how erratic his behavior becomes after this, but how he feels almost too afraid to be able to ever live up to what Citizen Kane was appeared to have done. And I think that already lends itself to the film he made after. Remind me again the name of the next film he made, The Magnificent Ambersons or something?
The Magnificent Ambersons, yeah. So that's the movie that really destroyed RKO. And I think Welles is in a long list of directors who made a movie in Hollywood and then had their asses handed to them and moved to Europe. I think one of the other ones is David Lynch, for instance. These directors who make a film and then are exiled. And in reality, it was Welles who exiled himself. So there's always this ongoing discourse, I think, in film criticism as well and in expert circles. Was it RKO and the whole Hearst controversy, because they tried to sort of silence the film or take it out of circulation, etc., that led to the train wreck that, in a way, is the Magnificent Ambersons.
The Ambersons, literature's most fascinating family, brought to the screen by the magic of Orson Welles. Richard Bennett plays old Major Amberson, tyrannical head of a family that had all the rights of royalty and none of its responsibilities. Dolores Costello returns to the screen with a magnificent portrayal of Isabel, the Major's daughter, who left the man she loved to wed another who was more acceptable. From Citizen Kane, you will remember Agnes Moorehead, who plays thin, spinsterish Aunt Fanny, a lonely woman in a house of wealth. No one would guess that Fanny had a secret love. Ray Collins is Uncle Jack, the black sheep of the Andersons. And Joseph Cotton, who plays Eugene Morgan, the man who came out of the past, find his first love once again. Finally, Isabel's boy, young George, played by Tim Holt, headstrong, impetuous, and arrogant heir to the splendor of the world. Young George, who hated Eugene Morgan, the man his mother really loved, and stood between their happiness like an avenging angel.
Don't you think you should tell George?
If you want to read up about what Final Cut means, I think The Magnificent Ambersons is one of the best examples. It's deemed one of the great lost masterpieces ever made. It's this big sort of family drama that was literally pulled apart between the studio and Welles, and then I mean literally that the frames of the celluloid were literally torn apart.
For context, I believe when Welles was signed to RKO, he was given this 2-movie deal where he was given full license over everything, including the final cut, which is pretty unheard of at the time, and I think also why there was so much tension between him and Hollywood, because it was something he was always fighting for. And I believe what happened with The Magnificent Ambersons is, so he had made like a 130-minute cut of the film, and the RKO executives screened it, did pre-screenings, and it didn't do so well, so they were a bit afraid. And during this time, Welles had then gone to Brazil to shoot a documentary, which was also a bit of a car crash in itself. And he basically would send notes back of how it should be edited. And the whole thing with Welles as well, I think, when we talk about film criticism and how whether he exiled himself or not, is he is a very problematic person and he is a narcissist. And so with that, you never know what he's saying is true and what's not, which only adds to the myth of the man and everything.
Yeah.
With Magnificent Ambersons, I believe RKO ended up cutting it down to 88 minutes and then reshooting the ending scene, making it a happy ending to sort of appease the audience.
Apparently, the movie's the original cut, and I think there are now more cuts available that slowly move towards what Welles maybe wanted to actually do with the film. But apparently the original long cut was full of long takes. One of the things that Welles has, I wouldn't say introduced, but he I mean, he was the master of the long cut. We'll come to a later film noir called Touch of Evil in a minute that that's actually famous for a long take that it starts with. But apparently The Magnificent Ambush was full of these long cuts. So what happens when you have a 130-minute movie that's full of these beautiful long takes and then the studio just recuts it to 88 minutes? Yeah, I mean, it's a horrendous thing. And then they released it as a double bill with a Lupe Velez comedy, which was, and according to the book that I'm here and now in front of me, it's just very, in one sentence says, it was a commercial disaster. So, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that movie completely went in the bin. But in a sense, maybe, happily enough, it also further took RKO down the bin. I think he still made this very fascinating Nazi war criminal film noir called The Stranger. And I think that one is still for RKO.
Yeah, on that, again, I was watching another, there's so many great clips of Orson Welles on sort of American TV chat shows. And again, this adds to this idea of you don't know when he's speaking truth or not, but he tells this story basically of how he's hiking in Germany with like an American compatriot. And this American compatriot, and this was during the 1930s, I think he was like an American teacher or something, and he was sort of like a fanatic of Nazis at the time. And it just so happened in the valley where they were hiking, he met some fellow Nazis, and then they ended all up eating together. And Wells claims he was sat there, and next to him was Adolf Hitler.
Right. This is such a Wells story.
The man sitting next to me was Hitler. He made so little impression on me that I can't remember a second of it.
Gee.
He had no personality whatsoever.
Wonder if under
he was invisible.
I wonder if under hypnosis it would come out.
No, I think there was nothing there that anybody'd remember till you had 5,000 people yelling, Sieg Heil.
Yeah.
Heil Hitler. That's the whole point of the story, that there wasn't anything to remember.
Again, it adds to the myth of Orson Welles. Take of it what you will.
This is so typical. It's such a difficult. Yeah. I mean, I love the. It's funny that later in life, when he's almost given up making movies, he just becomes the character of Wells. He just becomes the celebrity of Wells. And then he becomes such a Carson, and he's on Parkinson, and he's on all these shows where he's invited with nothing. He has nothing to tell except for, and what I find that fascinating, except for stories, for literally the art of storytelling. I think that's fascinating.
He also tells this other story of how
years afterwards I happened to be in Venice trying to get some money for a movie during the festival, and poor Churchill had been right after the war, as you know, crest of the greatest victory that any single man had ever presided over in modern history, was voted out of office, quite properly probably, but it was a tragic blow for him. And there he was in the hotel at the Lido with Clemmy, his wife, alone. And he'd go swimming out on the beach. And one day at lunch, I came in with a Russian businessman I was trying to hustle for some money for this picture. And as we passed Mr. Churchill's table, Mr. Churchill saw me and made that little gesture. And the Russian went out of his mind. This is a white Russian, not a red Russian. This is a, you know, a hustling semi-Armenian Russian. And when he saw that Mr. Churchill not only knew me, but gave a rather special acknowledgement, it was clear to me that I had the money for my picture. So the next morning I was out swimming in the beach, and I found myself paddling in the water right next to Mr. Churchill. And I hadn't gone up to speak to him, but there we were in the water, and I had known him on and off during the war in a humble capacity. And I said, and he had come backstage to see me. And I said, Mr. Churchill, I think you ought to know what you did for me. And I told him about how this acknowledgement had meant so much to me with my financier. And that day at lunch, I came in with the financier again. And Mr. Churchill rose from his chair and bowed.
Yeah, he makes The Stranger.
He makes The Stranger, but we don't necessarily have to talk about The Stranger. It's an interesting film. What I would say is mostly in his career, it's his start for making a couple of fantastic film noirs. The Lady from Shanghai that he makes after this in, I think, 47, if I'm correct, stars Rita Hayworth. And I think at that time, he's also married to Rita Hayworth, who is, well, considered one of the hottest actresses at the time, to put it bluntly. And The Lady from Shanghai, I mean, I used to be a very big film noir buff, and I loved like movies like Out of the Past and This Gun for Hire, and they're all about this very typical, I would say, a crime milieu that things take place in. But it's always a cop that's accidentally kills somebody and then needs to get out of the mess that he made, etc. But The Lady from Shanghai is almost this strange, I don't know, there's this aura of, you can feel that he's already like trying to play with this very sort of experimental ideas. It's a very strange film noir. It's like a fever dream, really. And mostly the best example of that in the film is the, shall we say, denouement, the conclusion, the well-known scene at the end with all the mirrors, that where he's like in the middle and there's somebody with a gun somewhere else and Rita Hayworth is trapped, etc.
We could have gone off together.
Into the sunrise, you and me, or you and Grisby.
I love you.
One who follows his nature keeps his original nature in the end. But haven't you heard ever of something better to follow?
No.
It's this weird, fascinating scene that's, I mean, copied in a lot of films, even I think in a James Bond movie, if I remember correctly. You can see aspects in that he's already like trying to do things that are so different, that are so almost, I would say, European. And I mean, that eventually leads him to really going into proper exile and moving to Spain, if I'm not mistaken, to make other very far more minor projects there. Like he makes Othello. Well, he still makes Macbeth in the States, but then he makes Othello in Morocco. And then he just becomes this sort of, for a while, he's just traveling Europe, making, well, I wouldn't even say making projects, like literally unfinishing projects. He makes Mr. Arkadin, which is, I think, all these films are, in a sense, very flawed, but have these strokes of complete genius in them.
I was reading that. So what would happen, for instance, with Othello, he would be shooting it in Italy. And then he would run out of money. He would leave the cast and crew in a hotel, fly back to America, do like these commercial roles to raise a bit of money.
Yeah.
Come back. And then that's why in Othello, for instance, you see literally the same scene, half of the dialogue shot in Italy, and then there's suddenly half of the dialogues in Morocco. But I think this is sort of his very unhinged years. And when we talk about him being a very problematic man, I think already in Lady of Shanghai, when he's married to Rita Hayworth, he's sort of, supposedly he drove her crazy in this sort of very like toxic, like mentally manipulative way. I think he even cut her hair off and made her dye it blonde, which sort of was his way of fighting back with the Hollywood studios, because they were sort of erupted into sort of fury with him for doing so. But yeah, I think it gives you an idea of the man he was becoming. And I think that's what leads maybe not nicely, but it leads into The Third Man, I think, in Carol Reed's film where he plays Harry Lyme, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, am I skipping too far ahead?
No. I mean, I think it's fine. Timing-wise, this is nice, because The Third Man is made in 1949. Again, a film considered a bit, we're going to put a word in between the and best, because The Third Man is considered to be, by many polls and the British Film Institute, the best British film ever made.
Is Mr. Martins engaged on a new book?
Yes. It's a murder story. It's based on fact. It's called The Third Man.
Best friend I ever had.
They
you're going to find me the real criminal. Sounds like one of your stories.
And if you, again, look at the film noir list, for instance, it's always up there. It's like Sunset Boulevard, I mean, Double Indemnity, and then The Third Man, right? So it's
Could you just give a brief explanation of what film noir is, just for anybody who hasn't listened to it? Obviously, they should listen to Nightmare Alley, the episode we did on film noirs.
But... Exactly. Yes. Yes. It's a very specific. It's hard to call it a genre. It's more. Well, let's call it a genre. It's maybe easier. It's these crime films from the 1940s and 50s that are very much influenced by German expressionism and have these very clear. The word film noir comes from the interpretation of French film journalists who saw this bleak existentialism inside these films, and I think that there's this tone in these films that is very bleak and very post-war, and it's always about a femme fatale, a woman that that betrays a man, and crime and murder. And they're, in a sense, funnily enough, because they're, in a way, they're pulp novels, and sometimes they're also based on pulp novels, and that ties nicely into The Third Man, because The Third Man is very different from all these things, but it's about a pulp novel writer. But the movie itself is not pulpy at all, because Carol Reed is bona fide one of the best British directors of his generation. And he didn't make a lot of great films later in his career, but this run that he had with The Third Man and The Fallen Idol, and I will point out a film that far too little people have seen, Odd Man Out, with James Mason, which is a fantastic British film noir. Again, a guy on the loose, on the run, blah, 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 you know, this kind of thing. But The Third Man is this... Maybe it's a bit the same as Citizen Kane in that way that it's this unique moment where a multitude of people who are at the top of their game sort of meet in this creative bubble. It's director Carol Reed. It's cinematographer Robert Krasker. It's
what did he make, just for reference? I don't know who that cinematographer is.
I don't know. I do not know. Shall we look this up? Because I'd love to know. No, I know that Robert Krasker and his photography in the film is amazing. Well, he mostly looks like a guy for hire. Oh, he made Brief Encounter with David Lean.
Ah.
Yeah, sorry. It's this meeting of minds, this unique moment where you have director Carol Reed, you have Robert Krasker, I will say Academy Award-winning cinematography, and you have novelist Graham Greene writing the screenplay and making this writing.
One of, if not the best 20th century writers, I believe.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
You've heard it here first.
He also wrote The Fallen Idol for Carol Reed, and if you're not familiar with his literary works, he wrote The Quiet American, Power and the Glory,
yeah.
That
oh, yeah.
are these classics of 20th century. Fiction. But and one more person to add to that list actually is Joseph Cotten.
Yes, of course. Who Wells had worked with in Citizen Kane already.
And he worked with Hitchcock on Shadow of a Doubt, I believe.
Yes.
Apparently Joseph Cotten was known to have said, Orson Welles said Citizen Kane was his best ever film. Carol Reed said The Third Man was his best ever film. Hitchcock said The Shadow of Doubt was his best ever film. What do all those three have in common? This guy.
Yeah, it's fascinating because Joseph Cotten is a very, he's not going to be the real star of any film.
Yeah.
He's a great, he plays this pulp novel writer who goes to Vienna, and he's a bit of a loser. And Joseph Cotten is the perfect man to cast in this. You feel for him. He's intelligent enough, but he's also a bit of a loser. You know, he's a bit of a sad guy. But he goes to Vienna because one of his best friends has died, called Harry Lime. And he goes there to investigate. And what he finds out is that because Lime has disappeared. Apparently he died, but nobody really knows how, and the body hasn't been found. And this becomes this sort of strange mystery. that in the middle of the film, and this is not a spoiler because the moment is has become so incredibly well known, Lime shows up, and is the this character reveal of Joseph Cotten's writer running through the streets of Vienna, which is beautifully shot. It's like every stone on the street constantly seems to be wet from a rain that has never fallen, really. Yeah, you can feel the shadow of the Second World War sort of moving still over Vienna while this is taking place. And then when he runs through the streets, he's following this guy, and at some point he loses the guy, and then somebody opens the door or the window and shouts like, "Hey, quiet on the street." And then the light of that room in the open window shines on this front of a building, and then bloop, suddenly you see a man standing there. And it's this iconic slow zoom or slow track towards the incredible familiar face of Orson Welles. And it's fascinating because we've been talking about this cult of the man, right? How he had just created this iconography almost of himself. And even in that part, the same thing happens. You know, it's like it only works because it's him.
Just to interrupt, it's funny that you say it's this guy running through an alley because, again, I was reading a bit about the film. And so Orson Welles became so difficult to work with in his later years, and especially in this film, that he would turn up so late to set that basically the AD had to put on a trench coat, the assistant director, and run through the alley just because Orson Welles was never there on time. Which again adds to it all in a way.
I mean, are they all having beers like up in heaven or in filmmaker heaven? You know, him, Marlon Brando, are they all like these pompous douchebags and Hitchcock? I mean
heaven or hell, we don't know.
Well,
purgatory.
Yeah, just purgatory. Yeah, cinema purgatory. But it's such a fantastic film, and I don't say this because I'm re-releasing it. I wouldn't have acquired the rights if I didn't think it's a fantastic film. Because it's also a very entertaining movie. What helps a lot is the soundtrack, the Zither, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, the Zither soundtrack. Zither is this small, it's like a sort of a banjo, really. It's like this string instrument.
Apparently it spent 11 weeks at number one. Carol Reed found the person who made the song in Venice, and it's like just playing at a dinner or something. He said, "You have to come with me," and then he brought him to London where he worked in his house.
Came up
with this iconic soundtrack.
Anthony Karras is his name. Yeah, it's amazing. And the funny thing is, my girlfriend hates that soundtrack now because I was going through the movie a couple of times, and it's impossible to get out of your head once you've heard it like twice. But what it does with the film is something that a lot of film noirs can be very, because of the heaviness and the black and whiteness and the stark contrast and it's microfilm and somebody dies and where's the body and things like that. And also because of the Vienna setting, this movie takes those elements and that sentiment and that philosophy almost of the film noir, and then does something very European and light with it that actually elevates it to a level of becoming a way more, maybe I wouldn't necessarily say way more entertaining, but way more interesting film as well.
Definitely.
I would greatly suggest everybody, because if it's now getting a global re-release, to go see it and don't be afraid about it being a film that's 75 years old, because it's hella entertaining, even for somebody who's been brought up with only movies in color. It's actually a funny anecdote, is that there's a conversation between Peter Bogdanovich and Peter Bogdanovich is a director who made a couple of, in the 60s and 70s, he's part of the new Hollywood group, as they would say, with Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola, etc. But he's a bit lesser known, but he was a very good friend of Orson Welles. And they had this ongoing discussion that Welles has always said that there never was a good acting performance in color. All good acting performances were in black and white.
There's so many, I can't think of any off the top of my head, I hope you can, but there's so many great lines as well from The Third Man.
The most famous scene, of course, and the most famous lines are in the so-called cuckoo speech.
I'd like to cut you in, old man. There's nobody left in Vienna I can really trust, and we've always done everything together. When you make up your mind, send me a message. I'll meet you any place, any time, and when we do meet, old man, it's you I want to see, not the police. Remember that, won't you? Don't be so gloomy. After all, it's not that awful. But what the fella said, in Italy, for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock. So long, Holly.
Yes, there's, again, talking about this, what is true, what has happened, what hasn't happened, what is the influence of Wells. The idea always was that he had insane influence on Carol Reed, but apparently that is complete torch, and Reed was very much in charge of this film, and the only real thing that Wells contributed to this film was indeed the most famous speech that he has in the film called The Cuckoo Speech, which I'm not going to impersonate here or go further into, but should we move on to what happens after this? Because what connects to this, and we'll do that briefly, we'll move back to Wells' own career. He moves back to Hollywood and he makes A Touch of Evil.
What are you trying to do?
I'm trying to strap you to the electric chair.
You framed that boy.
Framed him!
This is Mrs. Vargas talking. I just wanted to make sure I wouldn't be disturbed.
Don't you worry, Mrs. Vargas. Nobody's going to get through to you unless I say so.
Are you telling me you never planted any evidence, Sergeant?
Planting evidence? Framing suspect?
That's a lie.
I think I can prove it, Sergeant.
Which is another film noir, and one of the best film noirs. Again, A Meeting of Minds, him working with Charlton Ben-Hur Heston, who is very much, I wouldn't say in blackface, but in what we might call Cuban face for this film. Yes, thank God times have changed, but Charlton Heston is absolutely not a Cuban. Again, a film noir, yeah, I'm sorry to say this, but it's actually, it's mind-boggling if you watch it now. Again, a film noir that's very interesting because of the setting. It takes place not in the alleyways of San Francisco or New York. It takes place in South America. And the movie starts off with a bomb being put into a car, and then you and the camera following the car for, I think, like a 10-minute long take. That's just a bizarre thing in 1958. And that starts of a very elaborate, I would say a very also politically charged film noir, featuring stellar performances by Orson Welles as this incredibly obese, corrupt cop, Marlene Dietrich as a fortune teller. It's a wild film.
Just to add, Marlene Dietrich is sort of this very iconic German actor who...
Exactly, yeah.
Was this her first film in Hollywood or no? Surely not.
No. She made a couple of, she made with Joseph von Sternberg, who moved to here. We're not in Hollywood. Who moved to Hollywood and with von Stroheim, I think, who is, of course, also a German director. I think she already made some other films in the States as well, even in the 30s. So yes, she was here for here? What am I saying?
I am Hollywood.
She was in Hollywood for a while. I am already in Hollywood.
But for context, she is sort of one of these great actors.
She's a screen icon. Yeah, she's like in the echelons of Bette Davis and those kind of very iconic female performers. Because we also need to... I want to talk about F for Fake, and we also need to kind of wrap this up. Because what I want to do is I want to mention two things before we can talk about the end of the end of his life, really, and the end of his career. There's one thing I really want to point out, when he moves to, because he then again moves back to Europe, again with not a lot of money, again in this sort of I am in exile, I need funds situation. In that, he does make a film that I really love, which is called Chimes at Midnight, or in some countries called Falstaff, which is a Shakespeare play where he plays one of the most kind-hearted roles that he's ever played in his career, where actually he plays the loser. I won't go into it too much. It's a movie that if you watch it, you see that, yes, he doesn't have any money, but he has come to a point in his career where he can be an ugly guy, where he can actually let go a bit of parts of that narcissistic icon that he has built up of himself. And then we slowly come towards the parts that of his life, what we've actually been discussing quite a bit already, is him almost not really making anything anymore, really, but just being almost the interpretation of what people think of him.
Yeah, yeah.
The icon, Orson Welles, the man who gets invited to talk shows, who sits there quipping
with his cigar.
And I will say is that this might sound like a sad thing, but if you look at, for instance, this morning I was watching an old interview with him and Michael Parkinson, this, well, you know him, this well-known British interviewer. Yeah. All the comments below the YouTube video are, wow, I wish we had intellectuals on TV nowadays. And even though he sounds a bit pretentious, it's actually a bit revelatory to see somebody so eloquently discuss everything, really. He has something to say about everything. And he does it in such a quippy and eloquent and charming way. And you see that he's, especially in those final years, because I think he dies in 85, if I'm not mistaken, right?
Yeah.
He becomes so much softer. He becomes this sort of big teddy bear.
Yeah.
And I think he has come to terms with what he really is. And the question, and I'm going to connect this to the other film that we're releasing, because The Third Man might not be directed by Welles, but F for Fake certainly is. Or is it? That's the whole thing about this movie.
Ladies and gentlemen, by way of introduction, this is a film about trickery and fraud, about lies.
You don't talk about Napoleon or Julius Caesar. You're talking about Elmire.
Elmire?
Elmire?
Who is Elmire? That question has yet to be answered with any real precision.
Can I kiss you too? Anybody wants to eat?
In the world of the jet setters among us beautiful people, everybody knows Elmire. But Elmire what?
Yes, it's his world is a world of make-believe.
I'm not an actor.
Not an actor? Elmire?
I'm not an actor. I am not a professional actor.
He's a leading actor in this movie. His profession, it's true, is painting fakes. Among all fakers, Elmire is number two.
Once I saw a man from Ibiza writing a book on fake who came to see me to Paris. He said, I heard you are the first man who bought an Elmire.
And that man's name was
Clifford Irving.
He said, F for fake starts off with him actually saying that he's a charlatan.
What's a charlatan?
What is a charlatan? Oh, well...
Yeah, just for context, very quickly.
Somebody who might... well, what is a charlatan? How would you describe that? I mean, I would come up with another word that then sounds even more vague.
Yeah?
Snake oil trader or what?
Yeah.
No?
I think someone who's just uses deception, I think, is a very simple way to put it, sort of always tricking people and manipulative in certain ways that can either be harmful or not, but always for their own gain, I would say.
Right. Yeah. And it's a fascinating thing for him to say, because I think it's a documentary about a guy. Bear with me here. About a guy called François Reichenbach, who made a documentary about an art forger. I mean, come on, give me, because this is the most bizarre synopsis of a film ever. Trying to do it out of my own recollection. It's a documentary by a guy called François Reichenbach. No, it's a documentary. Okay, it's a documentary by Orson Welles about a guy called François Reichenbach, who made a documentary about an art forger called Emir de Hori, who is followed by a guy called Clifford Irving, who wrote a biography of Emil de Hori, but also wrote a biography of Howard Hughes. But the Howard Hughes biography is all made up. Howard Hughes finds out about this autobiography and then tries to get in touch with Clifford Irving that he, and this is Howard Hughes, and this Howard Hughes is the aviator guy that's been played by Leonardo DiCaprio. And that time he's like this big, the big multi-millionaire. Calls him up and like does a press conference to say that actually the entire biography is not about him. Do I still have your attention, Elliot? Do you still know what this film is about? No, exactly. And it becomes this sort of hyper convoluted but incredibly interesting documentary about what is real, what is art, what is forgery, what is a fake. Is a fake also art? But then he's Welles, this could have just told this with talking heads, but he constructs this as a magic trick. He starts off the film with him standing in front of a child and him turning a key into a handful of coins and then making it all disappear. And then he turns around and he looks at a woman. And the woman, by the way, is played by his wife, his then wife, called Oja Kodar. And he says to her, "I'm a charlatan. Haven't I always been a charlatan?" So the entire movie is constructed as a magic trick.
Yeah.
I won't spoil the ending because I think for a, again, air quotes, documentary, because I think this is the first ever mockumentary, really. Because it also mocks the idea of documentary as the pinnacle of reality, truth. Right? Of truth. And also, it just plays with the entire form. It's one of the most meta, mind-blowing things I've ever seen in my life. And not in a hyper-intellectual way. No, in a very later-in-life, Orson Welles fun way. It is one of the most fun, thought-provoking cinematic experiments I've ever seen. And he makes this... I don't know with what money, but he makes it. It's a very well-made film. And I think, and again, I'm not saying this because I'm releasing it. I think it is one of the most beautiful concluding chapters of a not only a director's body of work, even I think of a guy's life. Because his entire life has been about deception and or has it? We don't really know. What is real? Was he drunk in that commercial that we will now play for this French thing by Paul Masson?
Turn camera.
Marked.
102, take one.
With overlap, action please. Action Orson, please.
He doesn't do anything?
No, it's sorry, cut.
Yeah, rolling. 102, take two.
Ah, the French champagne has always been celebrated for its excellence. There is a California champagne by Paul Masson, inspired by that same French excellence. It's fermented in the bottle, and like the best French champagne, it's vintage dated. Cut. So Paul Masson.
102, take three.
Action, please.
Ah, the French champagne has always been celebrated for its excellence. There is a California champagne by Paul Masson, inspired by that same French excellence. It's fermented in the bottle, and like the best French champagne, it's vintage dated. So Paul Masson...
Ah, the French
there is a California wine by Paul Messer that has the same French excellence. It's fermented in the bottle and it's vintage dated.
While making money for probably actually producing this film, he was doing commercials, and there's this well-known commercial. And we, I mean, if there is a man that we can make fun of, it's Orson Welles. I think he was hammered drunk shooting the outtakes for that commercial. And there are multiple takes where you see him sitting next to, I think, two of the most professional actors I've ever seen in any commercial because they don't laugh. And they're holding this bottle of champagne up to him. First of all, he's just sitting there, and then somebody says, action. Orson, action. And he just goes like, he doesn't do anything. Like, oh, it's like, it's fantastic. I mean, he lived a beautiful life. Yeah. I mean, the only way to really wrap this up is tell everybody this entire episode was all a lie. We came up with all of this. Nothing in this episode was real. But that would maybe be too much of partly a spoiler for F or Fake and too much Orson Welles, really. Yeah.
I think the fact that we've been chatting this long about Orson Welles, and even I feel we've only really scratched the surface of him, sort of shows just how complex he was as a person and the life that he lived. And I think preparing for this episode, you also see, I think, Orson Welles, his life and who he is as a person is sort of a representation of someone who has fallen in love with an art form and what that does to someone, both the good, the bad and the ugly, and sort of like the relationship he has with that love. And yeah, I think you're just by going back and watching his films, I think you'll quickly become at least intrigued, if not fascinated, by who he is as a person. And what better way place to start than The Third Man or F for Fate? But I'd probably start with The Third Man first, because I think F for Fate, you kind of need to know a bit about who he is and watch some of his other films, I think, personally, before.
No, I agree. What I also take from this conversation that we have is that is a word that I just want to say, because I think that it would be a nice compliment for Welles' career as well, but also shows you how flawed it has been in a way, is that the thing that I love about him, he's been so uncompromising. He was so uncompromising in his career. Yes, that led to movies that maybe didn't work and he didn't have money and he burned bridges, but he, as you say, he was incredibly in love with his art form. And I think that there's still, I mean, maybe the interpretation of Citizen Kane being the best movie ever made will change through the decades, but I would say that there is a very inspiring idea or sentiment in the way that he was in love with the art form and that he just did whatever the fuck he wanted to do to make movies that he was proud of.
Yeah, and I think Citizen Kane sort of ignited something for American filmmakers, at least, sort of this belief of films can be commercial but art at the same time. And the auteurs that followed him, I think, are very much inspired by everything that he's done.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. Obviously, both F for Fake and The Third Man, if Tom hasn't told you enough, is being released at Lab 111. So please check it out. There'll be tickets and links in the show notes. Otherwise, listen to our conversation with David Hinton, who made Made in England, the films of Powell and Pressburger, another iconic filmmaking duo, who were also screening some of their films. Again, links for that in the show notes. And stay tuned for our next episode, which is going to be about female stereotypes in film that we love, featuring Basha Bor, that coincides with our Girls of Plenty program also.
And the release of her new book, which handles these themes.